Hello, listeners. Today, we're talking about queer werewolves. Yes, you heard that right. Like most monsters, werewolf mythology is deeply entrenched with representations of gender and sexuality. Vampires, for example, have a long history of acting as vehicles for queerness. Just think of the gay allegory of Anne Rice's Interview with the Vampire, or the lesbian undertones of Sheridan Le Fanu's Carmilla. In comparison, the werewolf has been grossly underutilized as a queer figure, an oversight that this podcast will address. Welcome to Unmanly Monsters, a podcast discussing the representations of queer masculinity in MTV's teen supernatural drama Teen Wolf, which aired from 2011 to 2017. Loosely based on the 1985 film of the same name, Teen Wolf follows high school outcast Scott McCall, played by Tyler Posey, whose life changes forever when he's bitten by a werewolf, giving him enhanced strength, speed, hearing, and the like. Where once Scott was a socially awkward, unathletic, severe asthmatic, his newfound powers secure him a starting spot on his high school's lacrosse team, the interest of a female student, and general popularity amongst his peers. But as Scott soon discovers, lycanthropy isn't all fun and games. Being a werewolf comes with its own host of issues, most of which relate one way or another to discussions of non-normative gender and sexuality. I first stumbled on the series in high school after one of my only openly gay friends recommended it to me, and quickly became a diehard fan. Upon reflection as an adult, it's no surprise that the show resonated with me so strongly. Even if I did not quite know I was queer as a high school junior, my taste in media surely did. Not only is the showrunner Jeff Davis a gay man himself, but the series just radiates queer energy, and was lauded at the time for creating a story world where homophobia simply didn't exist. From its numerous openly queer side characters to a plot predicated on the main character hiding a part of himself, it makes total sense a queer teen like myself was immediately entranced by everything Teen Wolf had to offer. But if one takes a closer look, it's not just the casual queer rep that makes Teen Wolf stand out amongst other aggressively heterosexual supernatural teen dramas of the time, like the CW's Vampire Diaries. Using werewolf mythology, the series was able to critique toxic masculinity, reveal the performativity of gender, and explore homosexual themes and identities. In this podcast, I'm going to break down each one of these accomplishments one by one. In doing so, we'll examine how Teen Wolf A subverts dominant representations of masculinity, and B presents the werewolf as a potentially queer figure. While Teen Wolf may not be perfect or entirely successful in its attempts to resist normative sexuality and gender, it still remains a worthy example of how such transgressions can be accomplished by using werewolf symbology. But first, it's important to look at what previous scholars have said about masculinity and the werewolf. So let's dive right in. All right, so why is the werewolf a masculinized figure? What about lycanthropy is distinctly queer? Well, first we have to take a look at previous on-screen representations of masculinity in general to determine what exactly is being resisted and or perpetuated. As Stephen Cohen argues in the seminal Masked Men, the post-war masculinity crisis created a bisected representation of maleness in cinema that would carry forward decades afterwards. He argues that two warring figureheads emerged, the man in the gray flannel suit and the tough guy, each battling for dominance over the other. The man in the gray flannel suit symbolized middle-class married men who, after returning from war, were expected to, quote, adopt a docile persona that is fundamentally at odds with their inherent masculinity, end quote. In short, rage was, and is, seen as a conventionally male emotion. Because of this, the man in the gray flannel suit acted as the, quote, safety valve for male aggression, end quote, due to his return to the domestic and feminized sphere. Place in opposition is what Cohen calls the tough guy, characterized by a psychopathy that, quote, contains the violence and anger of his tough masculinity, end quote, and harbors innate associations with hypersexuality and homosexuality. Thus, the civilized man and the psychopath are two sides of the same coin, each a flip away from eclipsing the other. Tanya Evans argues that due to a similar focus on emotional repression and male violence, the werewolf is based on this model of normative masculinity. Just as the werewolf is caught between their passive humanity and bloodthirsty inner beast, so does masculinity become a bisected entity of the civilized and the psychopathic. Both the werewolf and human male require some level of emotional repression to keep those around them safe from, as Cohen puts it, their, quote, anger and the violence erupting from it, end quote. In most werewolf stories, however, this repression often fails at one point or another, usually on full moon nights, demonstrating the bloody consequences of expressing this excessive and frightening male rage. Evans posits that because of its stark ties with masculinity, the werewolf is naturally equipped to challenge dominant gender discourses, namely by highlighting the toxicity of normative masculinity and by underscoring the performativity of gender through fantasy genre conventions. In this podcast, I adapt both Cohen's and Evans' arguments, which examine 1950s film and contemporary young adult paranormal fiction respectively, for teen television dramas like Teen Wolf, offering a new case study of the werewolf as a masculinized figure in a different entertainment medium and age grouping. Similar to Evans, I examine how Teen Wolf presents the supposedly inherent violence of lycanthropy and need to repress one's inner beast as toxic requirements of traditional masculinity that can and should be rejected. However, I also expand the general purview of her article to better encompass the queer possibilities of the werewolf as well. While Evans outlines how the werewolf is a vehicle for exploring nonviolent masculinities, thereby highlighting the performativity of gender, she does not substantially acknowledge the innate queerness of resisting these normative notions of manliness. In short, if the werewolf myth does indeed position toxic masculinity as something that can be resisted, and in doing so positions gender itself as a social construct, then the werewolf's liminality would in turn make it a distinctly queer figure. On this note, despite the atrocious lack of academic research when compared to other overly theorized queer monsters like vampires, the werewolf has previously been read as inherently queer by a few media theorists. As Bernhardt House argues, quote, "The werewolf is generally seen as a hybrid figure of sorts, part human and part wolf, and its hybridity and transgression of species boundaries in a unified figure is, at the very least, unusual. Thus, the figure of the werewolf might be seen as a natural signifier for queerness in its myriad forms," end quote. As such, the innate liminality of the werewolf lends itself to a queer reading. Unlike its human and animal counterparts, it cannot be so easily classified within normative social or sexual systems. In other words, like queer people, the werewolf is an outsider. This is an idea that I explore in my second segment, when examining the outcast character of Derek Hale, as well as the treatment of lycanthropy as a curse, which outs its victim from regular society. More so, Bernhardt House posits that the homoeroticism of the werewolf is, quote, "reflected as the beastly, unnatural, and atavistic natures often imputed to queer people," end quote. In essence, the werewolf is often depicted as a hypersexual, primal, and deviant figure. The same can be said for dominant depictions of homosexuality as inherently promiscuous and abnormal. Historically, lycanthropy was first conceived as a demonic possession, then as an extreme melancholic temperament, and finally as a, quote, "delusional psychological disorder, which in some cases is marked by sexual irregularities of all kind," end quote. As an example of the latter, Bernhardt House discusses Sigmund Freud's famous case of the, quote, "repressed homosexual with certain scatological and anal fixations," end quote, which Freud himself called the Wolfman, a direct synonym for lycanthrope, or werewolf. In this case, a young boy, or the Wolfman, had a dream involving wolves, which Freud interpreted as a primal scene of the child witnessing his parents have anal sex, eventually replacing his identification with the father for a homosexual desire for him. To be clear, Freud stated that he did not consider gay people to be sick, as outlined by R.A. Assay and A.A. Stone. However, he did champion the problematic idea that certain subconscious, quote, "environmental factors," end quote, like attachment to the mother or fear of castration, were determinants of homosexuality. Many of these elements conflate homosexuality with femininity, perpetuating the false and anti-feminine notion that to be unmanly is to be effeminate, and by default, homosexual. Since Teen Wolf features explicit gay representation, a psychoanalytic approach becomes less pertinent to my own case study, though must nevertheless be acknowledged, especially considering the historical treatment of homosexuality in horror. As Bernhardt House alludes to, just as the werewolf is an abomination of nature, so is homosexuality all too often represented as deviant, particularly in the horror genre. As Elliot Smith states, quote, "The horror film's representation of the other has long been understood to be a symbolic representation of social ills, anxieties, and unease. Non-normative sexuality, bisexuality, and homosexuality is often chief among these concerns. Various scholars such as Carol J. Clover, Richard Dyer, Harry M. Benshoff, and Jack Halberstam have covered how male homosexuality and horror is historically implicit and, quote, traditionally attributed to the monstrous, presented as abnormal, predatory, and evil, end quote. This harkens back to Cohen's argument that traditional masculinity is divided between the civilized and the psychopath, since the latter, quote, registers cultural apprehensions about the dangers of a militant, aggressive, and latent homosexual masculinity, end quote. If the werewolf is indeed a monstrous manifestation of male psychopathic violence and emotional oppression, as I argue in Section 1, then it is also naturally equipped with homosexual undertones. This becomes the main focus of my second segment, as I dive into the rampant homoeroticism of the series, as well as the ways in which Teen Wolf resists previous depictions of queerness in the horror genre. Rather than portraying non-normative sexuality as monstrous and symbolic, the show actually includes openly gay human characters and creates a story world without verbal or physical homophobia. As such, several scholars have studied the ties between gender, queerness, and horror, though few have investigated their presence in youth-aimed texts specifically, and even fewer have used Teen Wolf as a case study. Michael Johnson Jr. argues that while homophobia may not exist in the world of Teen Wolf, all explicit queerness manifests only in secondary characters. In contrast, all main male characters are young, heterosexual, white, and muscular. In short, they embody traditional masculinity, and are the only figures to receive dynamic, long-lasting storylines. I agree with the author's argument that while Teen Wolf was more progressive for its time, the queer representation on the show is still largely marginalized, presenting white heterosexuality as the quote-unquote norm. However, Johnson Jr. also glazes over the fervent homoeroticism that does indeed manifest between central male characters on the show. In doing so, he overlooks a major queer lens through which to view Teen Wolf, a gap that this podcast addresses by offering a queer reading of the latently homosexual and homoromantic relationships between the characters of Stiles and Derek, and Scott and Stiles, respectively. On the other hand, Evie and Zachary Kendall present Teen Wolf as a sex-positive, queer-friendly, and feminist text. They explore how the series centralizes enthusiastic consent, empowers its main female characters as more than mere victims, and openly discusses and accepts all sexualities within the story world. Their piece, however, ends up being too complimentary, thereby ignoring legitimate problems with Teen Wolf's representations of gender and sexuality as outlined by both Johnson Jr. and myself. Thus, with very little academic research written on MTV's Teen Wolf and on the werewolf as a queer figure, this podcast marks a new approach to this case study that is arguably more balanced in its arguments when compared to previous readings of this text. In other words, this podcast acknowledges how Teen Wolf both succeeds and fails in challenging dominant gender ideology through werewolf mythology, rather than devolving into superficial praise or an overly critical reading. Okay, so now that we've covered what other people have said about masculinity, queerness, and the werewolf, let's dive into my personal reading of Teen Wolf, starting with how the series uses lycanthropy to critique toxic masculinity. Okay, so like I said at the beginning of this podcast, after high school outcast Scott McCall is bitten by a werewolf, his newfound lycanthropy seems like a gift. With supernatural strength, speed, smell, and hearing, Scott suddenly succeeds in areas he previously floundered, such as school athletics, romantic relationships, and overall popularity. Granted, with the male ideals of physical dexterity and aggression, Scott is now able to claim the socio-political privileges of maleness that he was previously denied. But Teen Wolf quickly shows how these stereotypical masculine qualities are not only confining for young men, but outright problematic and ultimately avoidable. In doing so, the series offers a potential critique of toxic masculinity by portraying the hyper-male figure of the werewolf not as a paragon to strive for, but a poisonous pitfall to resist. In his study on toxic masculinity in youth-aimed television, Lindsay Roberts defines the term as similar to hegemonic masculinity, in that it is defined as a, quote, heterosexual masculinity threatened by anything associated with femininity, and widely accepted and expected of men, end quote. However, toxic masculinity differs from normative masculinity because of its, quote, sole focus on the regressive traits or toxic elements, end quote, of masculinity, such as an avoidance of femininity, which includes the repression of vulnerable emotions, and the expression of only aggression and anger.
The pilot episode of Teen Wolf appears to uphold these problematic characteristics, particularly by glorifying sports-related aggression in the pursuit of male power, yet soon demonstrates the harmful consequences of perpetuating toxic masculinity in young men. In a pep talk before tryouts for the starting lineup or first line of the Beacon Hills High men's lacrosse team, Coach Finstock underscores the direct correlation between adolescent male status and feats of athleticism.
Okay, you know how this goes. If you don't make the cut, you're most likely sitting on the bench for the rest of the season. You make the cut, you play. Parents are proud. Your girlfriend loves you, huh? Everything else is, cream cheese. Now get out there and show me what you got!
When Coach says, you know how this goes, he really just emphasizes how normalized the following statement is. That for a teenage boy, performing well in the sports arena means an uptick in social standing with other teens, parents, and romantic partners. Of course, to do so, players are required to be physically aggressive and to utilize traditionally male emotions such as rage. As such, it's no surprise that the captain of the lacrosse team and most popular boy at school happens to be the arrogant and overly hostile Jackson Whitmore, who can be seen on more than one occasion shoving other students against lockers or trying to hurt fellow players on the practice field. Jackson quickly clashes with post-werewolf bite Scott when his teammate's newfound athleticism threatens to dethrone him as top dog. However, in a subversive twist, Teen Wolf actually rebukes the idea that sports are a productive avenue to display traditional rites of maleness. While success on the lacrosse field certainly raises Scott's general popularity at school, it also becomes a danger zone for him. A dilemma that's explored in the second episode of season 1, titled Second Chance at First Line. After earning a starting spot on the lacrosse team in the pilot episode, Scott soon learns that exercising his aggression may not be the safest behavior, especially because his seemingly uncontrollable werewolf tendencies take over when he's on the field. From the moment he's bitten, Scott loses control of his own body, constantly at risk of transforming into his hyper-masculine alter ego. The metaphor for male puberty is quite clear. As his hyperactive and sarcastic best friend Stiles Stilinski explains,
the change can be caused by anger or anything that raises your pulse.
Which will, in turn, trigger Scott's urge to kill. Therefore, by expressing toxic masculine traits of aggression or rage, Scott risks turning into a bloodthirsty beast. Viewers witness the consequences of mixing sports-related violence with easily provoked werewolf transformation in the opening sequence of the second episode, where Scott attacks Jackson during lacrosse practice. After being knocked to the ground by Jackson, promptly humiliating him in front of the entire team, Scott is further goaded by their sadistic coach.
My grandmother can move faster than that.
And she's dead. You think you can move faster than the lifeless corpse of my dead grandmother?
Yes, coach. I can't hear you.
Yes, coach. Then do it again.
So, after being physically dominated by another player and then compared to a deceased elderly woman, Scott's fears of not being, quote, masculine enough, rise to the surface. Hidden beneath the visor and guard of his lacrosse helmet, Scott's eyes turn a wolfish yellow and his teeth sharpen into fangs, as both incidents encourage him to be more aggressive and less, quote-unquote, feminine. Scott then charges Jackson in an effort to reinstate his male power, flinging his teammate on his back in the process and consequently spraining Jackson's shoulder quite badly. Thus, by surrendering to the regressive male traits embodied by his werewolf form, Scott has indeed demonstrated who is more manly, in a conventional sense at least, but also seriously injures his peer. While this outcome should be of little surprise, since the natural byproduct of violence is pain, it still begs the question. If one of the logical consequences of toxic masculinity is physical abuse, then why do we continue to glorify this harmful manifestation of masculinity? The answer comes later in the episode when Stiles informs Scott that playing in Saturday's lacrosse game is not an option.
It's like I told you before. It's the anger. It's your pulse rising. It's a trigger.
But that's lacrosse. It's a pretty violent game if you hadn't noticed.
Well, it's going to be a lot more violent if you end up killing someone on the field.
Therefore, male aggression is not just encouraged but required within sports culture, as this exchange points out. How can Scott gain notoriety amongst his classmates, then, without being violent himself, and thereby putting everyone in mortal danger? This exemplifies a key contradiction within the discourse of masculinity, as there's both immense pressure to conform to dominant gender ideology, and a simultaneous toxicity in doing so. The werewolf thus becomes the perfect figure to explore this tension, as the supernatural abilities of lycanthropy allow Scott to succeed in the male discourse of sports, yet also threaten the safety of everyone involved. Moreover, when it comes to the second central characteristic of toxic masculinity, emotional repression, Teen Wolf similarly addresses the harmful effects of encouraging men to suppress conventionally feminine feelings of vulnerability. In the sixth episode of season one, Heart Monitor, Scott is forced to work on controlling his pulse, and thus his transformations. The only problem is that the abundance of potential triggers makes it difficult to keep his inner beast in check. In a noteworthy scene, Scott discusses these triggers with fellow werewolf and pseudo-mentor Derek Hale.
I need you to teach me how to control this.
Look, I am what I am because of birth. You were bitten. Teaching someone who is bitten takes time. I don't even know if I can teach you. What do I have to do? You have to get rid of distractions.
Derek says, while holding up Scott's cell phone to show a missed call from Allison, his crush. Derek then proceeds to smash the phone against the wall as he continues.
You getting angry? That's your first lesson. You want to learn how to control this? How to shift? You do it through anger, by tapping into a primal animal rage. And you can't do that with her around.
Thus, in a not-so-subtle way, Derek tells Scott that the only, quote, acceptable and productive emotion for him to express is anger, urging him to avoid all potential confrontations with feminine feelings of love or intimacy that he may have for Allison. In other words, Derek encourages Scott to adhere to edicts of toxic masculinity, which are represented by his werewolf form. Later on in the episode, however, Stiles points out the contradictory and harmful nature of Derek's advice.
What, he wants you to tap into your animal side and get angry?
Yeah.
All right, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but every time you do that, you try to kill someone, and that someone's usually me.
I know.
As is implied, how can Scott moderate his beastly anger by simply surrendering to it? The obvious outcome would just be an influx of serious injuries like we witnessed with Jackson, or perhaps even some of the mortal kind. Therefore, by encouraging men to solely express anger or aggression, we only perpetuate the vicious cycle of male violence. This notion is further explored when Stiles attaches a heart monitor to Scott so they can track his pulse and try to lower it when it gets too high. At first, Stiles forces Scott into increasingly stressful situations, like chucking crossballs at him, hoping that this aggressive quasi-exposure therapy method might help his best friend control his emotions. But in the end, the only thing that allows Scott to calm down is, surprisingly, Allison herself. When his economics teacher humiliates Scott in front of the entire class for not doing the homework, his heart rate skyrockets in response, although the possibility of Scott spontaneously shifting is quickly deflected as Allison grabs his hand underneath the desk and slows his heart rate to a normal human level. After class, Stiles suddenly realizes that Allison brings Scott back from the verge of shifting. At first, Scott denies this, saying that whenever he's kissing or touching Allison, it's hard to keep from changing. The conversation then continues as follows.
She brings you back, is what I'm saying.
No, 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 but it's not always true. Because literally every time I'm kissing her or touching her...
No, that's not the same. When you're doing that, you're just another hormonal teenager thinking about sex, you know?
You're thinking about sex right now, aren't you?
Yeah. So that's fine. Look, back in the classroom, when she was holding your hand, that was different, okay? I don't think she makes you weak. I think she actually gives you control. She's kind of like an anchor.
I mean, because I love her.
Exactly.
Therefore, instead of being a distraction or threat to Scott, Allison is a calming force. More than that, it's their emotional intimacy, rather than mutual physical attraction, that nulls Scott's toxic male traits. For example, when playing lacrosse, Scott often focuses on Allison's voice in the crowd to help soothe his aggression, allowing him to still play sports without hurting anyone. As such, while Derek urges Scott to give in to his anger and avoid his relationships with women, he actually controls himself by doing the opposite. Emotional repression is thereby presented as a cause of violence, not a cure for it. By portraying his love for Allison as a positive feeling instead of a weak and unmasculine quality, Teen Wolf critiques toxic masculinity through the werewolf mythos. More than that, in proving that the primal animal rage that Derek speaks to can actually be combated and resisted, Scott reveals the socially constructed nature of gender itself. As evidence argues, there is a stark correlation between becoming a werewolf and performing masculinity. The textual depiction of lycanthropy in relation to biological discourses is integral to whether gender is positioned as innate or performative. This is, in essence, if lycanthropy is presented as a disease, a genetic disorder, or a conscious choice. In the case of Teen Wolf, lycanthropy is portrayed as both something you can be born with, reinforcing gender as predetermined, or as an infection, suggesting the influence of an outside force.
"You're cursed, Scott,"
says Stiles in the first episode, underscoring how, unlike Derek Hale, who was born into a family of werewolves, Scott is made into one. For this reason, the gender traits associated with his beastly form, like violence and emotional repression, are similarly constructed themselves. As theorist Judith Butler states, quote, "Gender is in no way a stable identity or locus of agency from which various acts proceed. Rather, it is an identity tenuously constituted in time, an identity instituted through a stylized repetition of acts," end quote. Even before he becomes a werewolf, Scott engages in ritualized gender performance. For instance, in his first on-screen introduction, viewers watch as he meticulously strings a lacrosse stick in his bedroom, punches out a few pull-ups, and brushes his teeth, in what seems like a nightly bedtime routine of maleness. The hopeful outcome is to appear as masculine as possible in his dedication to sports, which in and of itself is a performative male discourse, and the muscular male physique. When it comes to lycanthropy, the full moon, which is an inherent signifier of nature, and the involuntary change that comes with it, may imply a certain naturalness to gender discourse. However, the fact that Scott is eventually able to resist shifting on full moon nights positions the hypermasculinity of lycanthropy as something that is repeatedly reinforced across time, rather than naturally embodied. Even the words used to describe his monthly change, like shift and transform, highlight the fluidity of gender as argued by Butler. Although this is somewhat complicated by the fact that the moon is also a long-established occult symbol of femininity and menstruation. In resisting the moon, Scott is in turn resisting his, quote, womanly side. While Teen Wolf is indeed discussing the performativity of gender in its textual construction of lycanthropy, it does so by engaging with latent anti-feminine sentiments. Moreover, the exaggerated style of the werewolf makeup borders on campy, further imposing an artificial aesthetic to the show's presentation of masculinity. In her foundational essay, Notes on Camp, Susan Sontag outlines a general definition. To start very generally, camp is a certain mode of aestheticism. It is one way of seeing the world as an aesthetic phenomenon. That way, the way of camp, is not in terms of beauty, but in terms of the degree of artifice, of stylization, end quote. When transformed, the lycanthropic characters on Teen Wolf have overly bushy sideburns, glowing neon eyes, sharpened fangs, pointed ears, and leathery skin with deep ridges. Altogether, it looks more like a garish Halloween mask than a convincing monster, making the werewolf design too much to take seriously, just like camp, and thereby calling into question the naturalness of gender as portrayed in the series. Lycanthropy and the gendered characteristics attached to it are a costume to be worn, not an innate state of being. In conclusion, just as the bodily appearance of gender is performative, so are the internal gender traits of male emotional repression and violence. In short, toxic masculinity is a social construction that is enforced and reinforced rather than inevitable. This is why Scott is able to actively reject the problematic edicts spouted by Coach Finstock and Derek Hale. Derek tells him in the pilot,
"You've been given something that most people would kill for. The bite is a gift. I don't want it."
Perhaps this is where the resistive potential of the series first emerges. That adhering to toxic masculine ideals is a choice, not a certainty. A curse, not a blessing. In Teen Wolf, the werewolf may be an exaggerated example of the poison of dominant gender ideology, but it remains an effective one. Scott may not gain cultural capital amongst his teammates, coach, or fellow werewolves for electing to be a less aggressive, more emotionally present person, But maybe that's exactly the point. By choosing those parts of himself that greater society deems unmanly, thereby denying his performative, bloodthirsty inner beast, Scott may just end up being a little more human than all the rest. But Teen Wolf's discussion of masculinity doesn't stop here. The show also explores male sexuality through queer side characters, close male friendship, and homoeroticism, which I will examine in the next segment. Since the show first aired back in 2011, fans and critics were quick to pick up on the, at times, blatant homoerotic overtones of Teen Wolf. As Jace Peoples wrote in their 2014 op-ed, right in the midst of the third season, quote, "Of course, any story dealing with werewolves would have found a home in the hearts of several LGBT fans. After all, this is a story about people forced to hide who they really are," end quote. Moreover, despite all main Teen Wolf romances being of the heterosexual kind, the most complex and compelling relationships on the show are, arguably, between the male characters. Said male-male dynamics are, by and large, presented as brotherly, either explicitly or implicitly. Yet, the intensity of these homosocial bonds, coupled with the overabundance of shirtless, muscular, conventionally attractive men, numerous homoerotic locker room scenes, and the fact that showrunner Jeff Davis is an openly gay man, often blurs the lines between male platonic and homosexual desire. As I discussed in the previous section, Teen Wolf appropriates werewolf mythology to critique toxic masculinity, specifically the regressive traits of violence and emotional repression. As the latter encourages men to avoid all associations with femininity, an intolerance of homosexuality is a recurring byproduct, due to the widespread conflation between the two. Thus, as I will explore here, the rampant male homoeroticism of the series takes this commentary one step further, queering the normative limits of male sexuality. Although, in keeping with larger homophobic standards of what is and is not quote-unquote acceptable teen content, Teen Wolf ultimately denies these queer possibilities through queerbaiting, which is defined as any storyline that refuses to define character sexualities while teasing the idea of representation, and by forcing queer-coded characters into heterosexual relationships instead. When it comes to Teen Wolf, the series both differentiates itself from and conforms to previous interpretations of queerness in the horror genre. For one, openly gay human characters exist within the story world, freeing homosexuality from the confines of being something that is A, purely symbolic, and B, associated with monstrousness. Danny Mahalani is a recurring character in the first three seasons of the show, serving as the openly gay goalie for the Beacon Hills lacrosse team. Season 4 introduces supporting character Mason Hewitt, human best friend of Scott's werewolf beta, Liam Dunbar. Just like their heterosexual counterparts, both Danny and Mason have healthy, long-term romantic relationships with other men throughout the series. More so, the queerness of these characters is in no way out of the ordinary. In a scene in the second episode of season 1, Scott admits to his male lacrosse coach that he can't play in the upcoming game because of personal issues, highlighting the show's nonchalance regarding fluid teen sexuality.
I can't play the game tomorrow night.
You can't wait to play the game tomorrow night.
Coach, I can't play the game tomorrow night.
I'm not following.
I'm having some personal issues.
Is it a girl?
No.
Is it a guy? You know, our goalie Danny's gay.
Yeah, I know, Coach, but that's not it.
You don't think Danny's a good-looking guy?
I think he's good-looking, but I like girls, and that's not it anyway.
In acknowledging that Scott may not be straight, without resorting to verbal discrimination, Coach Finstock both resists heteronormative assumptions and rebukes the pervasive homophobia of sports culture. Even more interestingly, Scott's slightly confused face as he utters, "I think he's good-looking," before quickly reasserting that he likes women, underscores the possibility that maybe even our central hero is questioning his own sexuality. However, as much as the series is more progressive in its explicitly gay side characters and absence of verbal or physical homophobia, Teen Wolf wholeheartedly denies the same queer allowances for the main cast. Despite being a popular, albeit non-canonical, relationship among fans, The sizzling sparks between Scott's neurotic best friend, Stiles Stilinski, and werewolf beefcake, Derek Hale, called Steric by the fandom, never came to fruition on screen. In an iconic scene in the 9th episode of season 1, Derek hides out in Stiles' bedroom as the police search for him, falsely suspecting him to be the culprit of multiple murders in Beacon Hills. After Stiles' father nearly catches the two of them alone, the looming homoerotic threat of being outed is quite clear, Derek pushes Stiles up against the closed door to ream him out. With nothing more than a few inches between their respective faces, both actors cast more than a few sensual glances at each other's lips while breathing heavily.
So all of us say one word.
I want you mean like, hey, Dad, Derek Hale's in my room. Bring your gun? Yeah, that's right. If I'm harboring your fugitive ass, it's my house, my rules, buddy.
Later on, Stiles encourages Derek to change his bloodstained shirt and looks on longingly at his hypermasculine torso. Stiles' presumed bisexuality is not a one-and-done sort of thing, however, but rather something that is littered throughout the series. From styling alone, actor Dylan O'Brien's lithe physique, hairless skin, and conventionally attractive features characterize him as a pitch-perfect twink, a gay archetype which Haramis describes as, quote, young, attractive, hairless, slim men, end quote. When it comes to his interactions with other characters, Stiles definitely demonstrates romantic feelings for Beacon Hill's high it girl, Lydia Martin, who he's fawned over since the first grade. But he's also prone to saying things like,
am I not attractive to gay guys? And I also gotta say, this newfound heroism is making me very attractive to you. No, seriously. Do you want to just try making out for a sec? Just to see how it feels.
Derek's queerness, on the other hand, is more subtextual and symbolic. In addition to being played by the gorgeous Tyler Hoechlin, Derek is a chronic loner, born into a family of werewolves historically persecuted by werewolf hunters, to the point of near extinction. When the series begins, Derek's family has pretty much been wiped out, save for his sister, whom he previously thought dead, and his uncle. Moreover, Derek's wolfish alter ego and subsequent isolation bear striking queer similarities to that of the Beast from Disney's Beauty and the Beast, which has previously been read as an allegory for AIDS, since the film's composer, Howard Ashman, was dying of the disease while writing most of the songs. Beauty and the Beast producer Don Hahn stated in an interview that the musical numbers Kill the Beast, in which the film's antagonist, Gaston, leads an angry mob of villagers to attack Beast's castle, was a metaphor for the stigma that went along with Ashman's disease. Bill Condon, the director of the live-action 2017 film, claimed that the character of the Beast himself also acted as a symbol. Quote, specifically for Ashman, it was a metaphor for AIDS. He was cursed, and this curse had brought sorrow on all those people who loved him. End quote. Similarly to the Beast's affliction, Teen Wolf repeatedly treats and even explicitly refers to lycanthropy as a curse that must be kept hidden for fear of outside judgment and perhaps even lethal consequences. In episode 2 of season 1, Derek warns Scott of the dangers of outing himself to non-werewolves.
You don't get it yet, Scott, but I'm looking out for you. Think about what could happen. You're out on the field, the aggression takes over, and you shift in front of everyone. Your mom, all your friends, and when they see you, everything falls apart.
Thus, if one looks a bit closer, it's seldom surprising that so many viewers felt baited by Steric's palpable sexual tension, especially when the actors themselves played into the chemistry between them in off-season interviews. A viral video, for instance, showed Tyler Hoechlin and Dylan O'Brien snuggling close in a 2014 promo for the Teen Choice Awards. Rather than confirming Stiles' sexuality and allowing the pair to get together for real, the writers continue to tease viewers with misleading scenes and leave all explicit queerness to peripheral characters. Stiles' borderline romantic friendship with Scott, which is less physically erotic but deeper on an emotional level, is likewise displaced by focusing on heterosexual pairings instead. When it comes to on-screen male friendships, numerous theorists have examined the inherent homoeroticism of what Jack Babusio once referred to as, quote, buddy love. In its more contemporary form, the bromance, DeAngelis argues that this representation of male friendship, quote, has come to denote an emotionally intense bond between two straight males who demonstrate an openness to intimacy that they neither regard, acknowledge, avow, nor express sexually, end quote. For anyone who has watched more than one episode of Teen Wolf, This description begins to describe the lifelong bond between Scott and childhood best friend Stiles. For the most part, the homosocial desire between Scott and Stiles is proudly on display. In true bromance fashion, they're not opposed to hugging or other forms of physical affection, and they often share their innermost fears, general anxieties, and emotions with one another. After his first transformation in the pilot, Stiles picks up a distraught Scott off the road.
Hey, we'll get through this. Come on, if I have to, I'll chain you up myself on full moon nights and feed you live mice. I had a boa once, I could do it.
He says, consoling his best friend with the promise that they'll face the challenges of his newfound lycanthropy together. However, contrary to DeAngelis's definition, which posits the heterosexual bromance as, quote, non-sexual and innocent, the emotional intensity of their relationship is actually acknowledged, and in many ways competes with that of other heterosexual romances represented on screen. This is especially apparent in the sixth episode of season 3, Motel California, when the differences between Scott's ephemeral romance with Allison and his deep connection with Stiles are highlighted. On their way to a cross-country meet, the gang is forced to stay overnight at an eerie motel notorious for the number of suicides that have mysteriously occurred on property. As Coach Finstock hands out room keys, Scott bunks with Stiles, a curious decision considering that Allison happens to be there too. Not only are single-gender boarding schools frequently associated with homosexual activity due to the close living quarters of their students, but the inherent queerness of two boys rooming together is made quite plain in subsequent scene, where two male teammates, Ethan and Danny, make out in their shared motel room. Thus, while Stiles and Scott may never take their relationship to a sexual or physical level, the homoerotic implications still remain apparent. Under the influence of the motel's strange powers, Scott and others on the team begin to experience strange hallucinations of their worst fears, driving them to apparent suicide. In the climactic scene, Allison and Stiles find Scott standing in the middle of a puddle of gasoline with a lit flare in hand. At first, Allison tries to draw him away from the edge with a few conciliatory, though ultimately meaningless words like, "There's always hope." Rather than engaging with Allison, however, Scott speaks solely to his best friend.
It all started that night, the night I got bitten. You remember the way it was before that, you and me.
He says, tearful, emphasizing their lasting partnership. As Scott contemplates being no one again in order to save his friends from the dangers that his lycanthropy brings to their lives, a crying Stiles steps forward to deliver one of the most genuine statements of the entire series.
This guy, just listen to me, okay? You're not no one. Okay, you're someone. Scott, you're my best friend. Okay, and I need you. Scott, you're my brother.
While his last word implies a platonic sibling dynamic, it acts more like a lukewarm cover-up for the otherwise intense homoerotic charge of the speech, as these two boys bear their souls to one another. Knowing that a single wrong move could kill them both, Stiles steps into the gasoline himself as Allison waits silently at a safe distance.
All right, so... So we're gonna do this, then. I think you're just gonna have to take me with you, then.
Therefore, the irrevocable bond between these two characters effectively blurs the lines between brotherhood and love. More so, in any other teen series, this kind of high-octane emotional beat would be offered to the heterosexual love interest instead, but here it seems purposely given to the male best friend. However, in the end, Teen Wolf's latent homoeroticism concerning Stiles, Scott, and Derek never manifests into anything more than a fervent undercurrent. All three main male characters remain canonically straight for the entirety of the series, and, to further course correct, end up in various committed relationships with female characters. Teen Wolf may be ripe with queer possibilities amongst the main male cast, but continually sidelines these opportunities. Thus, the series lies suspended in a curious space where homophobia supposedly doesn't exist within the story world, evidenced most potently by openly gay side characters whose non-normative sexuality is more commonplace than in most other mainstream texts. And yet the show still relies on outdated methods of relaying queerness as something that can only exist, for the most part, off the radar, out of sight, and in the shadows.
So we've explored masculinity, queerness, and the werewolf in the teen television drama Teen Wolf. But what does it all mean? In the first segment, I argued that the series appropriates werewolf mythology as a critique of toxic masculinity by demonstrating the harmful consequences of encouraging male violence and emotional repression, as well as underscoring the performativity of these edicts and of gender itself. In the second segment, I argued that Teen Wolf further challenges dominant gender ideology in the horror genre by featuring openly gay human side characters and homoeroticism between main male characters. Ultimately, however, the show exercises heterosexual displacement and queerbaiting. Therefore, even though the series made strides towards more inclusive and resistive representations of gender and sexuality, Teen Wolf remains constrained by the largely heteronormative system that produced it. While diversity in contemporary television is still a slow-going process, and never without its faults, we continue to see more and more explicit representation on screen. In teen supernatural dramas alone, we have recently witnessed multiple reboots and reimaginings in the vein of MTV's Teen Wolf, except now with central queer characters. Netflix's Chilling Adventures of Sabrina, for instance, features an array of queer main characters, including trans and genderqueer representation. In a second example, the CW's Charmed is led by a trio of female witches, all of whom are women of color and one being a proud lesbian. Thus, when these recent installments are acknowledged, how does the queerness of these texts compare to that seen in Teen Wolf? How does queerness within the horror genre change as representation becomes more explicit? These are both potential questions that could be explored in future research. Because even if Teen Wolf fans never got a canonically bisexual Stiles Stilinski, today's queer teenagers deserve to see their identities reflected, front and center. This podcast was written, researched, and produced by me, Hannah Landreville-Miller. I hope you enjoyed it, and thanks for listening.